This is Ask the Investigator, the podcast that navigates the high seas of professional investigation, gives the warning signs of when it's time to stop being your own Dick Tracy and call a professional, and offers tips on what to do before making that call to help your cause. Now, here's your host, Ken Cummins.
Hello and welcome back to Ask the Investigator. This is our third podcast, and whatever you're listening to us on now, whether it's iTunes, Google Play, or Stitcher, you can find the first two podcasts on there also. The first one was about finding assets, collecting on your judgment, and the second one was sexual harassment, sexual misconduct investigations. And this week we're going to focus on what I call personal investigations, which we get a lot of requests for personal people wanting to find out about personal issues about their family. But first, I want to welcome our wingman, Christian Duvall. Welcome back, Christian.
Thank you very much. Thanks for having me.
And how's things with you?
Everything's okay. Looking forward to this podcast.
Yeah, we'll get into personal investigations first, but first we got to welcome our co-pilot, Tish Few.
Hey, Ken.
How are you, Tish?
I'm doing pretty well. I'm excited for this episode.
Yes, this is one of the most requests we get from people, from individuals. It's to find out information, personal information, whether it's their daughter is about to marry somebody whom they don't believe is really worthy of their daughter's hand, or it's a nanny check, or it's somebody they just met at a bar. We get a lot of requests for people who need to find out what's going on with that person who has suddenly come into their life.
Mm. And Christian, what type of, do you have any experiences with personal investigations, and what type have you had experience with?
Yeah, I most certainly do. Some can be quite unusual. I'll tell you one right off the bat was about a young lady who wanted to see if her significant other would cheat on her, and she wanted us to provide an investigator to seduce him, which we refused to do based on ethics. We thought it was unethical, but that was a pretty interesting. We also had to guard a minor child who was about to be sent to rehab. We had to be outside his house during the entire night to ensure that he would not escape his place of residence and that his escort could take him safely to rehab.
We've had a lot of these type of investigations. People wanting to check out their nannies. Like I said, people wanting to find out who their son or daughter is marrying, or who somebody has met online and wants to know, is that profile that they are being given real? When the internet first started and before Facebook exploded, we had a case where a woman called me from Paris, and she had a friend who had fallen madly in love with a guy online, and she had bought a ticket to come visit him. And every time she would start to come, he would say, oh, I got a business trip this week. Oh, there's a sickness in the family. So her friend didn't believe what was going on. And they hired us to track this guy down and get a picture of him. Well, he described himself as 6'2", brown hair, green eyes, drove a sports car, had a sailboat, looked like Tom Cruise. And when we actually found the guy, he was in his 60s, short, gray hair, he had black rimmed glasses, very frumpy looking, wore a flannel shirt, smoked cigarettes heavily, and he was having the time of his life up in the top of his house each night, creating this whole fantasy world for himself.
So. And this is the problem with the online dimension. Previously, people met people through friends, for instance, or they met them at places, at the opera, the theater. Well, from nowadays, people are very busy feeding the insatiable market economy, and that online phenomenon has contributed to people post a meeting online, and you have no idea who you're meeting. There's no one to vouch for the person you're meeting online. They could be putting a persona for all you know. And that's why the need for investigators has increased significantly, as you need to know, who is this person I'm talking to? Who is this person I'm developing interest for? And you've had the stories of obviously with Craigslist and the Craigslist killer and
yeah, you know, it's very true. And one of the requests we get most often from a woman or a man, they're about to get married, they want to know, okay, he's told me he might have a child somewhere. So was he married before? He's made references. You know, they're picking up clues, but they don't really know this guy. So I want to know, was he married? Is he divorced? Does he have a child or does she have a child somewhere? What is her history? And that's quite common. We had one, the weirdest one, was a guy called me. He was driving to work. He looked across and he thought he saw in the car going in the other direction his old girlfriend. So he said, find out if she's in town. And so we did. She wasn't in town at the time he thought he saw her. She lived several states away. She was married. I didn't even contact her. I went back to him, said, nope, she's not here. And he said to me, I said she's married and has a family in another state. And he said, oh, yeah, I'm getting married next week.
So wait. So first, that sounds like he's angry. And that's a weird reaction to the fact that she's married and lives out of state. But I want to go back to the unethical.
You think he was lying when he said, I'm getting married next week?
I mean, it's really just that sounds retaliatory. Like he's just like upset that, you know, hey, she's married. She's moved on without me and I can't contact her.
Well,
she's not interested.
I hope so, because that marriage probably wouldn't have worked out if it had gone ahead. But anyway, I'm sorry. You were going to ask Christian.
Well, first, I want to go back to the unethical situation you brought up in the beginning. You know, it's great that there are standards. However, would that person be able to get help anywhere?
Yeah, a less ethical investigator might be able to oblige. And, you know, it's a form of entrapment. And actually, there are reality shows that I've seen in other countries where that's
right.
Part of the reality show, seducing and see if the person will succumb to temptation. And for us, it's unethical. We're investigators. We're not there to initiate or participate or create any situation.
Right. We had another one where a woman suspected her boyfriend was a heavy drug user. So she wanted us to meet him at a bar, you know, run into him at a bar and see if we could get him to buy marijuana from
us. And for
us.
That one, they wanted us to go to the place of residence, I remember, and sell cocaine.
Yeah.
Or see if he would take cocaine.
Jeez.
So that's asking a lot. But we've neglected to mention that on most of these types of investigations, now, when we're trying to find somebody, we're looking at the background of people, but when we're trying to find someone, when you're asked to find an old girlfriend, an old boyfriend, a long-lost family member, our policy is always to say, we'll find them, we'll tell them you hired us to find them, find you, but it's up to you. If you say you don't want us to tell our client where you are, then this is as far as it goes.
Now, speaking of finding, you had once a case involving a someone of a Fortune 500 company asking you to find a daughter's cuddle buddy, a blanket, what was that?
Oh, my grandson hates this story because I've told it so many times at career days in school. But he called me up one morning early in the office and said, and this is a personal investigation, said, you know, my daughter won't stop crying, my wife won't sleep with me, you know, my life is ruined. And I said, well, what's the problem? He said, well, my daughter was, 9-year-old daughter was on a field trip to Washington, D.C., and she lost her blanket, her blankie, her comfort blanket she sleeps with every night. And so we went to the hotel where they had stayed, and we asked to, and the hotel management threw us out, threw my investigator out. Because said, oh, we don't steal blankets. We don't steal from kids. And he went around to the back, and he spoke Spanish, and he talked to the help. And they told him, they let him in, and he looked through he talked to the maid who cleaned the room. He looked through the box of lost and found. It wasn't in there. But then she told him, oh, but these bus trips, they're handled by another company. And he went there, and he found the blanket. It was about to be thrown out because he thought it was just a rag.
Wow. So, you know, from these...
And I've always wanted to turn that into a children's story. Detective, you know, detective story.
The pet detective of children's blankets.
right. Now, we were talking about, you know, we get
private investigations.
We talk about our clients. We get them agree that, you know, we before we take the case and they say, you're going to pay us some money, we're going to find the person. But if they say no, then no means no. And, you know, they have to accept that policy up front. And some of them say, no, I'm not going to do that. And they hang up. And only once did the client get mad when we came back to him and said, we found your daughter, but she doesn't want to talk to you. And then he went on the Internet and kind of trashed us, but we just ignored it.
Now, in terms of personal investigation, we also had one involving a college student's parents who wanted us to find out whether he was, because, you know, a lot of parents here, some parents are paying a lot of money for their kids to go to school, and some kids might not necessarily take this opportunity to study. They might actually have a good time instead. So we were hired and retained to find out whether their child was going to class. Now, I remember another investigation involved one of our investigators had to go get a massage to get information out of the masseuse regarding a domestic investigation.
Yeah.
We get those as well.
Oh, wow.
Occasionally.
Yeah.
So online, the online platform is obviously a big one. You alluded to earlier having a gentleman who, it reminds me of a Brad Pitt Paisley song, Online. He's 5'3", but online he's 6'2".
Well, just like army impersonators. You have those all the time, and they pretend to be someone they're not, and they'll act a part, and they will put photos of them in an army uniform. And it could be someone out of Ghana trying to, you know, have a romantic relationship. Mm-hmm. And some people feel very lonely, and they get all this attention all of a sudden. And a lot of these, you have to be very careful with these scams, because eventually, the person communicating with the other person will develop feelings. And the person will say, I am sick. I'm having this surgery. We've been speaking for 6 months. I need you to wire me some money.
Right.
And a lot of times, these individuals disappear. So you need to be careful who you're talking to.
Wow, and then you have the parents where you said you talked about the university, but then there's also parents that are, you know, running background checks on
absolutely
possible newlyweds.
Whether they
right.
like the newlywed, the prospective husband or wife or not, they want to know who they are. And you'd be surprised. Some people will conceal previous marriages or children or criminal records. It's unfortunate that it has gotten to this point.
Yeah, they want to know who their son or daughter is marrying, and they want to know they want something that they can go to the child and say, hey, you're making a big mistake. And, of course, if there's nothing there and they still don't like the choice, they like their future son-in-law or daughter-in-law, they have to accept it. But the saddest story saddest case we got involved in was an elderly man. He called his wife had died, and he remembered a woman he almost married in 1948. And he called us during the 90s. And he wanted to get back in touch with her. He wanted to see if she maybe was widowed now and they could get back together in their golden years. And so we found her. She was married. And when I called her, she said, oh, God, no, don't tell him where I am. And so we didn't. But then she asked me a lot of questions about him, how he was doing and everything. And so when I went back to him, I told him, yeah, she doesn't want to talk to you. And, you know, he was heartbroken, but he accepted it because that was the condition we had agreed to help him.
Yeah, I mean, background checks are very important, and I think we've given a lot of information. Today we're going to talk about adoption cases and how to find biological parents, siblings, and other family members. You know, Ken, what type of companies arrange adoptions?
Well, they have law firms. In our next segment, we're going to have one of the leading adoption attorneys in the country on to talk about this. But it was really hot about maybe 10 years ago because we were working with adoption agencies because they had to involve the father. Before that, it was just the birth mother who had to give permission, but now they had to involve the father. And a lot of times they couldn't find the father to sign the adoption paper. So we got involved to track down the father. And then we started getting involved with parents who had adopted children. They want to know, okay, what can we find out about the medical history of the people, the mother and the father, you know, which involved kind of really putting together a family tree and see if we could determine whether there are any mental illnesses or anything like that in the family. So it's a very intense and very elaborate deep dig sometimes. I was hoping to have on this program a gentleman. We found his daughter after many, many, many years, and he had given us a letter. We gave the letter to the daughter, and she agreed to meet him, and now they're both having this wonderful relationship, and I wanted him to be on the program, and he said, no, my daughter's convinced me to go to rehab, and this is my rehab time, so I can't appear.
Well, next we will speak with Harvey Schweitzer after a word from our sponsor. Support for Ask the Investigator comes from Capital Inquiry, Inc. If your business is considering an acquisition or merger, hiring a top-level employee, or experiencing internal employee disputes or fraud issues, then you need to call Capital Inquiry. The firm's experienced investigators will find solutions to your problems. Call Capital Inquiry at 800-530-0766 or send an email to info@capinc.com or check out the website at www.capinc.com. Today we're going to talk about adoption cases and how to find a biological parent, siblings, and other family members. Ken, can you introduce our guest?
I'll be more than happy to, because I've worked with Harvey. Our guest today is Harvey Schweitzer. He's an adoption attorney. He's a great guy. He actually helped me with my adoption. And we've worked for him. We used to help find the biological fathers who had to sign papers. So I'm going to let Harvey explain the whole adoption world. But welcome, Harvey.
Thank you very much. I'm really happy to be here and talk about this subject in terms of adoptees who find their mothers, their fathers, their siblings, their relatives, and vice versa. Parents who gave up children for adoption, trying to find them now. And the first thing I'll say is it's a whole new world out there.
Yeah. So explain that, because I know it has changed a lot since the 30s, 40s, and 50s. So how has it changed?
It's changed in so many different ways. First of all, the public cultural attitude toward adoption has changed. It used to be adoptions were secret, they were confidential. Many times children weren't even told that they had been adopted. And for some reason, as a culture, as a society, we wanted to keep adoptions to be a secret. That's totally changed now. There are estimates that over half the people in the United States have some contact with adoption. Either they were adopted, they know somebody who was adopted, they have a sibling who was adopted, they have a relative who is adopted or placed children for adoption. So, you know, the term I've heard used is adoption nation. Where
So you're saying that if you were adopted in the 30s, 40s, or 50s, it's pretty much impossible for you to, if you later in life you want to find out who your birth parents were, it's pretty much impossible?
It's extremely difficult, if not impossible. The reason being, as you mentioned earlier, only the mother was involved in the adoption placement. And unless she was married, then the father would not be involved. But the big difference is the amount and quality of the records that the adoption agencies had to collect, and the amount and the quality of the records that the court wanted to see before they granted adoptions. I've seen some court and agency adoption files from the 40s and 50s that barely had anything in them, practically no information anywhere in either in the court file or the agency file. Now, and I think for maybe the past 10 or 15 years, there might be 100, 150, 200 pages of records in an agency adoption file, background information, medical information, hospital records of the mother, the father, all different kinds of things are going to be in there, information about siblings.
Who is that file accessible? Does anyone get access to that file, or how is it shared, if at all?
There are three different kinds of files that usually come into existence. One is the court file. One is the file that the adoption agency has, if there is one. And then the other files would be maintained and controlled by the attorneys. Let's talk about the court file. Court files is state by state law. Historically, they were sealed files. Nobody got to see them. In order to see the court file, you had to file a motion to break seal.
Right.
And they were sometimes granted, sometimes not. And even when they were granted, sometimes they only allowed you to access non-identifying information. In other words, you couldn't use them to track down the parents or the siblings. The other file are in the hands of the adoption agency. And once again, historically, adoption agencies never revealed those files to anybody unless you had a court order. And those court orders were extremely hard to get. Now everything is changing. Some states are adopting open records laws. You can get your original birth certificate. Courts are more prone now to issue orders to force the agencies to reveal their files. However, identifying information, who your mother was, who your biological father was, do you have any siblings, that kind of information is still not all that easy to get. It's easier now than ever before, but unless, well, it depends on the circumstances
right.
of the adoption.
But it didn't exist before, basically, so now it exists somewhere. It's just you got to figure out how to find it. What kind of, now when you say that it's changing, the father has become involved now, the biological father, how has that changed things?
Now there are people who want to find not only their mother, but their father. And it doubles the number of people that can be searched for, if not actually increases it, because then there's going to be two extended families.
Right.
So it's increased significantly the number of people that might possibly be found if you're trying to find your biological, your relatives.
But what rights, the fathers now have more rights than they did before, right?
Fathers have equal rights to mothers.
And when did that change occur?
There was a major Supreme Court case, I believe, back in the late 60s or 70s. I don't have the date in my mind, but there was a major Supreme Court case that changed everything. Because up until the Supreme Court case, married fathers had rights. But if the mother and father weren't married, unmarried fathers didn't have any rights at all, unless there was some strange state law that gave them one. And when I first got into this, which was in the late 70s, is when the law was changing. So the case must have been late 70s, because I remember when I used to go to court back in 78, 79, 80, we had an expression. When the judge said, "Who's the father?" we would say, "Your Honor, paternity has not been established." And we didn't have to, because the mother was not married. And that was the end of that. Once you said paternity was not established, the case just rolled right on through.
No.
That's impossible now. Impossible to do it that way.
So, I have a quick question for
sure.
you. When the father, now, as fast forward a bit, how many men have you encountered or have you seen over the time who have come out and wanted to find their children? Who didn't have, you know, maybe they didn't play a role in the decision, but now you have all this access to information.
I would have to say that it's about half the number of the mothers. And also, the number of mothers and fathers coming to me to search has gone down greatly because of the introduction of the internet. But there are fathers who do call me. They want to track down the child, and sometimes for them it's a lot harder than the mother, because they may not have nearly as much information as she had, and a lot of times they're starting from scratch, because a lot of them maybe weren't even involved in the adoption case or may not even have heard about it until after it was all over, and even if they were involved, they still don't have much information. But if I'm allowed to tell an anecdotal story, that reminds me of one of the most interesting cases I ever did, which was a father. No, it was a son. He was looking for his father. And the only thing we were able to find out about the father was that He graduated from the University of Maryland, and the car he drove, the kind of car he drove when he was a student there. And Ken, I don't know if this was a case that you did for me, but I remember saying to the father, as the son, you know, I don't really think we're going to be able to do this. And the investigator found the guy. He found him. And I remember talking to him and asking him, how did you do that? And he explained how they did it. They pieced this. They got a list of all the graduates. They matched them with the motor vehicles and the students that had car passes on campus. And they found the individual, and they reunited.
Yeah. Well, there was no information before. What kind of, but going back before it changed, what kind of paperwork was involved? Is, I guess it was just the mother had to sign, and then what are the agreements now?
It's a whole new world now, because not now you have birth mothers and birth fathers who actually meet and interview the adoptive couple. You have exchanges of information. Sometimes it's only first names, sometimes it's first and last names, and sometimes they even know each other and can track each other down. Number two, one of the biggest changes is what's known as a post-adoption contact agreement, where it's usually the mothers, but sometimes the fathers, who, when the adoption is granted, they have a contract with the adoptive parent or parents that they're going to be able to stay in touch with the child who's being adopted. Sometimes it's only letters, sometimes it's Skype, sometimes it's email, sometimes it's telephone calls, and sometimes it's actually the visits.
Yeah.
Once a year, twice a year, even more than that.
I have a question for you regarding these new laws, our availability of information. Does it have mostly a positive effect? And if so, is there also a negative effect?
My guess is going to be that it's mostly a positive effect. We don't really know enough about post-adoption contact agreements and the, you know, how beneficial they are. But what I do know is this. Number one, the stigma around adopting has been reduced significantly. And therefore, this openness, I think, is good for everybody in the adoption world, because it's available. Nobody says you have to do it, but it's out there. The second thing that I think it's good is that what we learned is that children want to know where they came from. And you could argue that they shouldn't want to know, or we don't really want them to know, but they do.
Well, you know, it's understandable that they need to know, because we've had a number of cases where they wanted, the adoptive parents want to know what is the medical background of the family, who the birth family and their relatives, because they need to know that later on. They're going to need to know something about the family medical history to be able to cope with their own medical history.
And that's been one of the major driving factors in record keeping. As a matter of fact, many states have passed laws that require adoption agencies to collect all this data and turn it over. And there are some states that have rules and laws that the parents who are adopting have to sign an affidavit before the judge will grant the adoption that they have been supplied with whatever background information that the agency has been able to obtain. And also, the one thing that I also don't want to forget to remember is that not all children who are adopted are infants. We always have this picture in our mind that children, they come home from the hospital, they're given to a new family, and they grow up. A lot of children who are adopted are foster children who are anywhere from toddler to teenagers. And they know their family. They know their extended family. They know their grandparents. There's no way you can cut them off from them, no matter what you do.
I want to go back to this contact agreements, because that seems to me that could be fraught with a lot of problems. You've adopted a child, but you've got the birth family always interfering, wanting can seem like there's a possibility they'll always be interfering on how that child is raised. Have you seen that kind of problem arise?
This is really a unexplored territory, because you use the word interfere. And that's always been in the minds of the adopters, that we want to raise this child. We don't want to be told that, oh, we're not doing it right. So that lurks in the background. Number two, we don't have enough what we call longitudinal evidence on post-adoption contact agreements in terms of tracking them through the adopted childhood and adolescence into adulthood to see, are they really working to the benefit of children, which is why the only reason why we should be using them is to benefit children. So your answer, unfortunately, right now, we don't really have enough evidence, and we might never have enough evidence, because I don't know of anybody that's attempting to do any sort of a comprehensive study on how are these things working. Anecdotally, I can tell you that birth mothers and birth fathers move on with their lives. And even though they sign these agreements and they might visit for the first 6 months or the first year, eventually life goes on. And the other thing I want to say really quickly is that no matter what happens with the post-adoption contact agreement, you can't undo the adoption. The adoption cannot be undone.
As an investigator, one thing I'd like to say is when we attempted to help some of these kids who wanted to find out who their parents were, one of the things that they really needed was to bring closure or answer questions that were unanswered for the entire life. And from my experience as an investigator, whether or not the adoptive parents agreed to be contacted or not, the child was very thankful to us to say, well, at least I'm able to, even though it's a no, I'm able to close in some ways this chapter of our life, or I'm able to answer some questions.
Right. Yeah, I think Tisha has a question.
And Ken, you alluded to the internet earlier, Harvey.
Yes.
Can you lead us into that part of the conversation?
How has the internet changed? You said it has changed it tremendously.
Here's what I'm finding out, and here's what I'm being told. The internet, number one, has changed everything, and number two, everybody is finding everybody on the internet. There are no secrets, and you can't hide. In other words, children who are adopted, who want to find their biological parents and their biological family, they seem to be able to do it. Biological parents, fathers, and relatives, they go online, and people are tracking each other down. Now, how often that's happening, I don't know. But I do know that it is becoming increasingly easier to do online. I understand there's even websites for that now, you know, where birth mothers can go and log in and say, I'm so-and-so, I gave up my daughter in such-and-such a year in such-and-such a locality. Is there anybody out there who's looking for their mother who was adopted around the same time? And so that's how it's happening. As I said before, there was even a conference at a law school in Ohio a number of years ago on the impact that the internet is having on the ability of biological parents, adopted children to find each other.
And I think it's important to know that DNA technology also has become much more economical, much more accessible. There are platforms from nowadays. We're speaking about the internet. And I'm not going to do any advertising, but you have 23andMe. They will send a kit to your house. You will give saliva. They will profile. They will give you your DNA profile. Not only do those sites give you a possible relative based on your DNA, but they also give you the list of illnesses you might be predisposed to having based on your DNA. So this also might influence people locating their birth parents.
Harvey, how has this changed your practice then? What's your practice consist of now?
I think it's a potpourri of a lot of different things, all of which in some way revolve around children. I still do adoptions. I do a lot of what might be called unusual adoptions, but I also do the step-parent adoptions. I do adoptions for foster parents who are adopting foster children. I do a fair amount of interstate adoptions. I do relative adoptions where grandparents are adopting their grandchildren. But I also do a lot of work for adoption agencies, for foster care agencies. And every so often, you know, children will come to me, or really adult children who are trying to track down people or they want certain information about things. I keep pretty busy. I've been doing this for a long time, and you never know what's going to walk in the door next.
Well, what about international adoptions? Because they seem to be the rage 10, 20 years ago, but now they're really fallen down.
Here's the word on the street. The word on the street is that the era of international adoptions is over. The numbers are plummeting. A lot of international adoption agencies either aren't in existence anymore or they're retooled themselves to do something else. International adoptions simply are not occurring at nearly the number they used to be. And there are reasons for that. One of the biggest reasons is that there are now a lot of countries who don't want to export their children. They want to adopt policies and practices that enable children who are orphaned or can't be cared for by their own parents to be cared for and adopted in their own country. Number two is that a lot of people simply don't want to go overseas to adopt children anymore. They prefer to do what's known as artificial reproduction technology. Number three is that the United States, as a policy, is not really encouraging international adoptions. In other words, they view this as being something that is now come and gone. It's over with. Americans should not really be traveling all over the world trying to adopt children from other countries. And this doesn't affect just Americans. In other words, when Americans were adopting internationally, so were all Europeans and Australians and people from New Zealand. But the international adoption numbers are way down, and most people don't think that they're ever going to go back up again.
So the artificial reproduction technology, what happens in that case if, you know, let's say, you know, hypothetically speaking, I have a child from a sperm donation and they want to find out who their father is?
There are two different kinds of sperm donors, or I think it's possible to put sperm donors into two different categories. One are the unknown sperm donors. In other words, this was artificial reproduction technology that was handled by an ethical, properly maintained policies and procedures concerning unknown donor sperm. I don't think it's possible to find out who the donor was. I'm not that close to this area, but as far as I know, unknown means just that, unknown. However, if the sperm donor is known, and a lot of sperm donors are, because the women who get pregnant using known sperm donors, they know who these people are. Well, not only can you track them down, they have rights. In other words, a known sperm donor, even though the sperm donor was told, hey, listen, I just want your sperm, no child support, none of this, you have no rights, you have no responsibilities. The law doesn't look at it that way.
And unfortunately, you have also individuals who will, and there have been cases involving sperm extracted from a discarded contraceptive and injected with a syringe, which the court ruled that didn't matter how the woman got pregnant. The fact is the father would have to pay child support. Or you had the opposite effect, too, where a male would tamper with a contraceptive, make holes, and get the woman pregnant.
If you're a man and you made a woman pregnant, and you go to court and you say, Your Honor, she tricked me into making her pregnant, that argument is, as we say, not going to fly. So because there are men who were tricked into providing sperm under some fairly bizarre conditions. And what happens is life goes on. The children get older. And all of a sudden, the woman realizes, hey, this guy, he should be contributing. He should be paying child support. Or what sometimes happens is the men have a change of heart. And they say, hey, what happened to that little boy, that little girl? I'm going to go back and check on them. And all of a sudden, they're filing a custody action. And guess what? They succeed. They actually can get custody and visitation under those circumstances.
Well, it certainly has changed a lot. And we want to thank you for your
I'm happy to be here.
Expertise and your wisdom. We certainly could go on for a while with this. But the one thing I would say is I think we have a lot more, like you said, a lot more people trying to find their birth parents, their sister or original, their biological sister or brother. And so there's a lot, and it's getting a lot easier to find that information.
Thank you, Harvey. Next, we will continue discussing after a word from our sponsor. Our sponsor this week is Capital Inquiry. Ken, that's your company. Tell us about it.
Yes, that's my company. We've been in business since 1991. We've handled just about every kind of case imaginable. And, you know, we're focusing this week in our sponsorship on the kind of investigations we do for businesses. And you mentioned a few in the first sponsorship promotion. I want to take this opportunity to say we do a lot of international trade investigations, trademark infringements, intellectual property violations, where we have to, a lot of times we're investigating the Chinese and how they've contrived to cheat to get an unfair advantage against American businesses. So if you've got a business that's experiencing those kind of problems, give us a call. We've done investigations nationally and internationally all over the world. We have a very experienced team.
For more information, feel free to call Capital Inquiry at 800-530-0766 or send an email to info@capinc.com or check out the website at www.capinc.com. Ken and Christian, that was pretty powerful. Harvey is definitely a wealth of knowledge. We covered, you know, end of confidentiality, post-adoption contract agreements, the internet and how that's changed adoptions, as well as international adoptions and sperm donations, which to me is it's as an almost 40-year-old woman, that feels, you know, that's kids right at home to figure that stuff out. So overall,
yes.
You know, hopefully we can have him back for more wealth and more knowledge.
Yes. I'm sure we will. So,
wait,
Christian.
I do have one important question.
Okay.
I'm going to cut you off. I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
But I think everyone wants to know, Ken, did you work the case from the University of Maryland, the son looking for the father? Were you the one on that one?
We were involved in that, yes. That was piecing together information. And the reason, and that's a good example of what you can do when you don't think you have much to go on. It may take a while. It may take a little more money than you thought, but there are ways to piece things together to figure out, narrow down the field, and then when you get it narrowed down, you can kind of say, okay, it's one or two of these people or it's this person. So it's a puzzle, but yes.
I'm proud to know you then. It was great. Christian?
Well, the teaching moment of the day.
Teaching moment of the day.
I will say, you know, for adopted kids, they're as Harvey said, there's a wealth of resources out there. Don't give up. And I know, you know, a lot of you need to have closure or understand or piece up the missing puzzle. And you know, it's wonderful that we have attorneys like Harvey or investigators who are dedicated to locating missing parents. And the result of the investigation might not always be positive, but at least you know it gives you one more piece of information. And in terms of the individual who are unscrupulous, be very careful. You know, as you've heard, there's been stars and football players who have been tricked. And what a lot of the celebrities will do is discard their contraceptive and flush them down the toilet. That's the safest way for you not to become a father unknowingly.
Right. Yeah, I agree. If you have a need to know, you know, now's a good time. You want to find out about your adoptive parents or your brother or sister out there or the extended family, your biological family you came from. Everything is possible now in this day and age.
Before we run out of time, Ken, can you tell us what we're going to talk about in the next episode?
Number four, we're going to talk about finding missing persons investigating human trafficking. And when I say finding missing persons, these are people that are, you know, there's some risk to them. Teenagers, younger kids who've been kidnapped by their parents, or by a father or mother, or people who've just gone missing. And, you know, for medical reasons or whatever, there's a sense of urgency to find him. But we're going to have Ed Gavin, who is an investigator from New York who does human trafficking investigations. He'll be on to give us a lot of his stories. And they're pretty powerful, and some are hard to take.
If you have any questions or comments or topics you would like us to consider, please reach out to us at askinvestigator@gmail.com. Follow us on Twitter at #AskInvestigator, and thank you.
Yes, and I want to thank our band, Bomas Prindon, which has provided us the music. Thank you, and we'll see you next time.
You've been listening to Ask the Investigator. Send your comments, questions, and suggestions to askinvestigator@gmail.com and follow us on Twitter at #AskInvestigator. Thanks for tuning in.